Chapter 8. After Lex traced the stolen booze to a warehouse on West 212th Street, he collected me with a truck bearing the name Crankshaw Furniture Removal. In the rear of the truck sat two trigger men, Charlie Antrader and Fatty Walsh, both carrying Thompson submachine guns. When I asked Lex why all the heavy hardware, he told me it was time I got smart about guns. A pistol, he pointed out, forces a gunman to move in dangerously close to his target, and if the first bullet fails, the target usually shoots back. A sawed-off shotgun, he said, has the same problem. It works best at short range. And buckshot doesn't always pierce heavy doors or the metal bodies of automobiles. But a Tommy gunner can make a kill, sometimes several, at a reasonable range or from the safety and anonymity of a speeding car. The Tommy gun, he said, had an additional virtue. It deterred fire from the victim's bodyguards, who either went down with their employer or dove for the nearest cover. When we turned into 212th Street, I saw a cat scurry across a crumbling wall and disappear. Street lamps had never been installed in this part of town. Clouds muted the moon. In the dark, I saw no one. We drove slowly west toward the river, where a windowless, grubby brick warehouse, which Lex had been told held AR's liquor, loomed large and dark. A chain-link fence with a sagging gate secured with a padlock barred our entrance. "Just remove the gate from the hinges," I advised. Jack climbed out of the truck and spoke to his boys. They scampered out with a bag full of tools. In no time, they lifted the gate from one of the posts. We drove quietly up to a metal door, equipped with a peephole, and bolted from the outside with a hasp and a combination lock. Legs turned off the motor, and the four of us took up our positions. And Trotter and Walsh stood on either side of the door with Tommy guns at the ready. Legs taped over the peephole and circled the building for a quick look-see. When he returned, he said the only windows in the building were high up on the walls and boarded over. "I can open that thing with a tire iron," observed Lex. "AR said he wanted a clean job, no marks." I forcefully pulled the shackle toward me and slowly turned the dial, feeling for gaps in the gears. Sure enough, I could detect the openings. In under 2 minutes, I had the lock open, and to my great relief, the door was not locked from the inside. It opened with a turn of the handle. As I crept in, I could feel Lex's breath next to my left ear. He had a police revolver at the ready, a Smith & Wesson 38 Special. And Trotter remained outside, and Walsh slunk in right behind Lex. An image of three tiptoeing little piggies crossed my mind, as well as the fear that if gunplay erupted, I'd be hit first. Once inside, we were immediately accosted by Fluff, rabid Fluff. It hung in the air, coated the walls, entered our noses and throats. I could hardly breathe. In front of us, we saw a maze of flaking yellow cubicles, hundreds of them, each barely lit by a small bulb suspended from an overhead wire. Every space held four ebony girls, bent over a table, picking the rabbit fur and stuffing the fluff into large burlap sacks. Rabbit fluff was once again in fashion in poorer European circles for ladies' collars and caps and muffs and stoles. I had read about thousands of young Caribbean women illegally employed in huge warehouses, isolated four to a tiny cubicle, working 12-hour shifts, picking the fluff. But I never myself expected to stumble upon such a scene. All the windows were closed and no one talked, for good reason. The fluff was so fine that it filled the air and slowly crept into the lungs with every breath. According to the Times, the average life expectancy of fluff pickers was 6 years before they died of consumption. The danger, of course, was that if one started coughing, so too would others. It was like the effect that occurs in a theater. Several people clear their throats. The next thing you know, everyone's coughing. If that happened here, and the women couldn't make a speedy escape, they would all begin wheezing and quickly suffocate. We didn't dare talk in this atmosphere. So Lex, pointing his pistol at one of the young women, led her outside to ask where the liquor was hidden. "There's no liquor here." From the look on her face, he could see she was telling the truth. "Ask the boss, Makut." Lex's famous anger volcanically erupted. "You dumb shit!" he screamed, putting his pistol to Entrada's head. "Your goddamn sauce lied to us! I ought to put a bullet between your ears!" Charlie Entrada, a spiffy dresser and a dandy, came unraveled as he pulled at his shirt collar and oozed sweat from his scalp to his shoes. "All I did was tell you what wax he told me." "Shut up, you moron." Lex shoved the woman into the warehouse and mumbled something to the effect of not wanting to incur Eeyore's displeasure again. "Let's get out of here," barked Lex, and started to climb into the truck. "Well, what the hell you standing there for?" he yelled at me. "Get in!" "We can't just leave these poor women here," I said. "They're worse off than slaves." "Who cares about donkeys?" snapped Lex. "Now hop in." "I think we should locate the owner and get him to clean up the warehouse. Geez, at least he ought to ventilate it." "Are you nuts?" asked Lex. "In case you forgot, we ain't reformers. We're the people reformers want to reform." Waving his pistol out the window, he again ordered me into the truck. This time I listened. As Lex had predicted, A.R. seethed about the loss of the liquor and the misinformation. His lower lip twisted with disdain, and his voice grew dry and hard. "I want to know who's behind this, and I want to know now." When I called to his attention the plight of the women in the warehouse, he shrugged and said, "I work for money, not for goodwill. You can do whatever you want, but you'll have to do it on your own nickel. And by the way, you still owe me. Our deal was you'd help me recover my liquor. What you found was Schwarzes, not scotch." "I did open the lock." Running his tongue across his false uppers and smacking his lips, he patted his pocket and took out his wallet. "Okay, Coakley, here's a C-note. I don't want it said that AR's a Welcher, but I repeat, we ain't even yet." "I'll take the 100, but I still need the diamond." "Believe me, they're trying to pull a fast one." "Mysteria said by September 1st. "Don't worry, he can't read a calendar." "No, but Sukania can." That evening, as usual, AR left Carolyn at home while he haunted the boulevard. I found her reading a book. "You look worried," said Carolyn. "I am." Filling her in on the missing diamond and the threat to my mother and Ben, I asked if she'd heard anything on the grapevine. "Just what I've read. The Farouk diamonds are famous. They'll probably be sold in Europe by some fence." Looking around as if the place were bugged, she whispered, "The person who'd know is Federico Truffer, a wheeler deal of fence who is a familiar figure in the underworld." "Never heard of him." "He owns the Club Ball in Harlem. He's eccentric." The first person who came to my mind was Susie Somerset, who cared for me when Mom was sick. Our housekeeper, cook, and my second mom had been living in Newark. I immediately made inquiries. Yes, she was still working for Al Siegel. Yes, she could spend a day with me in Black Harlem. And yes, she would help me look for Mr. Truffer. But in the meantime, there was Rodman's trial.